Welcome to the Nevada Court of Appeals. Assisted here today with my colleagues, Judge Abby Silver on my right and Judge Jerome Tao on my left. We're looking forward to all the arguments, and this first case also arises out of the pro bono program, so it's nice to see the oral argument that's given as part of that program. The first matter we're going to hear today is Reese v. Hughes. It's case number 66436. And all right, who's going to be arguing for the appellant? Okay. All right, and who's with you, Mr. Anderson?
This is Elijah Reese.
Okay. All right, good afternoon, Mr. Reese. All right, Mr. Anderson, please go ahead. Do you have 15 minutes? Do you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. All right,
thank you. So this is a custody case with the child having been relocated by the mother to Texas without the consent of the father. And really the key to this appeal, to the problems that we see and where we find the error on the part of the district court, comes down to a span of time between November and December of 2013. In the beginning of November, the couple, Elijah and Brittany Hughes, were preparing to extend their lease. On the 4th of November, an incident occurred where Brittany struck Elijah, broke his computer, and threw some objects at him. Elijah called the police. Brittany was arrested and then submitted to a plea of first degree domestic battery, an offense which by statutory definition constitutes domestic violence.
Wasn't it a submittal, though? It wasn't a plea?
That is correct.
So it's not a plea, because at the end of a submittal, it's a dismissal.
That is correct, but it still ultimately carries that charge.
If it's dismissed, it's dismissed.
Well, it's still carried with it the requirements of, I believe, in her case, doing service and having to take a domestic violence class.
Okay, but that's not a plea of guilt. A submittal just means you pass it, you do some counseling, and the case is dismissed. It really means almost nothing.
Well, I suppose my terminology may be incorrect, but moral of the story is that she was not found innocent. She did submit to the charges brought against her, and it was not a lone incident by both the testimony of my client and also by other issues which were raised.
But the district court in its decision makes a specific factual finding that there was not sufficient evidence presented at trial to determine whether the allegations of violence are credible and which party was the primary aggressor. Now, that's a factual finding. We can't just revisit the facts. We have to give that deference. If that's a finding that the district court made, you know, standing up and arguing that it happened, well, maybe it happened, maybe it didn't, but the district court said it found it not credible, so we're stuck with that, aren't we?
Well, our contention is that the district court did that blatantly against the weight of the evidence. If I could point out a few specific things. First of all, Elijah's testimony was that this was not a one-off event, that it had happened repeatedly. And even Brittany's father, when he was asked about, when Brittany's attorney was trying to frame that Elijah had also been violent, he never could testify that Elijah had actually acted in any way violently, but made the quote, "You hear that she pushed me or she did this when you're right in front of someone in their face." My reading of that is that he's essentially assenting to the fact that yes, I am aware that she has struck him, that this is a pattern, but I'm justifying what she's done. And so our argument here is that yes, the court did make a finding of fact that that domestic violence was not properly evidenced, and it happened on both sides. But our argument basically is that that's just not true. I mean, you had a submittal plea, you had the testimony both of the father and of the relatives of the mother, which showed that there was a pattern, and you even had a protective order being issued by the district court, which I am aware is contested by the mother. But there was a strong pattern substantiating the idea that domestic violence had occurred against the father with pretty much nothing going the other way. And so that is our argument, is that was clear error on the court's part to not find that. So the next step then is that Elijah starts preparing his request for custody. You look like you're going to ask me a question.
Well, I was just thinking about the point that Judge Tao was making, because the court made some findings in its order, but then at the very end of the order concluded that it couldn't tell who was the primary aggressor or if it was even sufficient to be domestic violence. And so the court didn't apply any presumptions. So if the court was wrong in that regard, what's the next step?
Well, by the statute, that creates a presumption in Elijah's favor of that he is the proper person to have custody. Also, the fact that there was an abduction, which I was going to get to later, mm-hmm. that she did not have his consent, and that under Drugman there was custody, shared custody between them, also creates a presumption in his favor. And then further, the text message that she sent saying that the reason she relocated.
I want to ask you on that text message. You brought that up in your brief, too, about the text message. But correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't that an unauthenticated text message attached to a motion? There was no testimony or actual evidence presented at the trial itself talking about this text message. Because I would agree with you. If that was presented, that's very strong evidence of an abduction as opposed to her just leaving inappropriately. But from what the respondent has claimed in their answering brief, this was something that was just unauthenticated and attached to a motion. How the district court didn't get to consider it? How do we get to consider that?
Well, oh, hi, Phil. I've said to my client many times, I just wish so badly that it had been brought up in trial, because it really would have been a slam dunk. But the facts are that...
You weren't the counsel.
I was not the counsel. But the facts are that it had been submitted to the court along with a motion. That motion had been answered, had been tried by the other party. The other party never raised any issues of authentication. And even in their opposition, the other party has not even gone so far as to say that text message was not actually sent. So, I mean,
isn't it a stretch to call it an abduction rather than a wrongful removal? I mean, the judge obviously didn't think it was an abduction. He awarded custody to the mother and let her stay in Texas.
Well, I think that the statute and the case law pretty well makes it abduction. I assume I don't have any argument that Drugman does give custody to parents who are living together without a custody order.
Yeah, no, that's not in dispute.
Okay, the statute says that abduction means a person who leads, takes, entices, or carries away or detains any minor with the intent to keep from his or her parents, guardians, or any other person having lawful full custody of the minor. And that is what happened. There's no testimony contrary to the fact that the child was taken to Texas. He was told after the fact that the child was taken to Texas.
Well, the district court's order calls that inappropriate. Now, I'm not entirely sure what that means, because that's not a word in the statute, but if it means anything, it seems to mean that he's trying not to use the word abduction. So, in other words, he doesn't make a finding that it's an abduction.
Right, and I would say that's clear error, because the statute requires a finding as to whether or not an abduction happened to take place. And when your order essentially says, yes, every single thing that constitutes an abduction happened, but then stops short, it seems to me like you're kind of playing cute with the statute to avoid the outcome that you want.
Well, I mean, if that's what he's doing, though, I mean, he's a district judge. If he's trying to play cute, that's essentially another way of saying he doesn't want to find that it's an abduction, because he's heard the testimony and doesn't think. I mean, isn't that what you're saying? You can call it playing cute, but the other way to say it is he's not finding it's an abduction.
Well, I would say that when you set out the elements of an abduction, whatever word you then follow it with, you've still found an abduction. I mean, that's It's defined by the statute. It's not defined by the district judge. And when the district judge says that all the elements of the statute have been satisfied.
So why is the child still in Texas?
Clear error. I mean that would be the thing. And you know, and that's the thing, is that these things create create presumptions in the favor of Elijah that were not properly addressed. These findings should have been found in his favor. They're still presumptions. They still can be overcome, with the exception of if you do decide to take that text message for what it says it is, that goes a little too far, because that would be bad faith.
I mean, the mom obviously did a lot of things wrong. That was error that in the court, and the judge still made the ruling. She like had a strike against her, maybe two strikes against her, but he's still ruling her favor. I mean, wasn't he looking at the best interest factors? I mean, he went through them in his order.
I would agree that he was, but the statute is clear, and the statute is aimed at the best interest of the parent. That these things actually need to have real rulings, and they need to be correct rulings, and those rulings then have to be addressed as the presumptions. In other words, the outcome that we would like to see, and that I think that Elijah is entitled to, is for this to be remanded, for a finding of domestic violence to be found, a finding of abduction to be found, and hopefully a finding of bad faith as well. Certainly, at that point, he would, at a new trial, he would submit those text messages properly. And those would completely change, those findings would completely change the, or maybe they wouldn't. I mean, but it's in the interest of justice. It's absolutely necessitated by the law and by the statute that then he would have, the playing field would change to define the best interest of the child.
Okay. All right. You're at 4.5 minutes left.
Thank you. Right. That would be my kind of a nice conclusion.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Henderson. All right. Welcome, Ms. McFarland.
Good afternoon. We're dealing here with a situation where the judge had an evidentiary proceeding and made very clear findings on the evidence that was before him.
Clear? I don't know if that's the word that we would apply in this case.
Yeah, I mean, this is my question. The flip side of the question I asked your counterpart was this. The district court's decision also makes a finding that there was violence between the parties throughout the relationship. Both parties instigated this violence. The children frequently were present when the parties were violent. Isn't that a directly contradictory finding to the one that I recited to your counterpart? And to the extent that the district court makes flatly contradictory findings, what are we supposed to do with that?
I don't think it's contradictory, because we have findings of there being domestic violence, there being an inability for the judge to assess the credibility of who's the primary aggressor. And I'm sorry,
I don't mean to cut you off, but I'm looking at their finding of fact in the district court order on page 4, finding of fact 21, quote, "Mom grabbed and hit Dad and tried to keep him from leaving the home." Then on the same page, on the finding of fact number 28, "Dad hit Mom's arm with the car door. No criminal charges resulted." So you have two findings of domestic violence in the findings of fact. And then in the order, the judge writes, "There was not sufficient evidence presented at trial to determine whether the allegations of violence are credible." There's two findings of domestic violence, and then in the conclusion, there's a conclusion of law that there's no domestic violence. Isn't that inconsistent in itself, the findings from the conclusion?
I don't think when he says that the findings, there wasn't sufficient evidence on credibility, I don't read that to mean that he made a finding that there was no credible evidence of domestic violence. That's not how I read that. Because other conclusions were that there was violence on both sides. And so from my reading of the findings and the conclusions, the presumption for domestic violence is only invoked against one party if there's only one party as the perpetrator. If the court finds that both parties are perpetrators of domestic violence, then it doesn't invoke only against one person. So in that situation, the court can either find domestic violence and invoke it equally against them or not invoke it against either one, which is what the court has done in this situation. So while there were findings that there was testimony on both sides of domestic violence, there wasn't a finding or a conclusion that it went one way sufficient to invoke the presumption. And that's the important part. He went through and analyzed the evidence that was on domestic violence, but because of the fact that it was both sides, he couldn't go in and make a conclusion against one of them. So it can't be error to not invoke it against her when he actually analyzed the facts and the evidence on both sides and came to an equal conclusion on it.
So what's your interpretation of what the district court did? Did it find that there's no violence and therefore the presumption doesn't apply, or did it find that there was violence, the presumption applies, but the presumption has been rebutted? What's your interpretation of what the district court actually did?
That's a good question.
Or it applied and there couldn't determine the primary aggressor.
Well, so we have... That's an interesting question.
You guys, I don't know, in civil, you guys do your own orders to the district court. I'm just curious, do all the district courts just do their own orders in the eighth then? Because generally in civil, the attorneys, the prevailing party,
sends in the order. That's generally what we do, but it is not what happened in this case.
Okay.
So in this case, the court issued a decision on August 5th and then an order that just contained the orders from that was issued the next day. And so the court actually wrote all of the wording.
It almost seems like they stuck the boilerplate in there, not taking a look at their own findings.
Yeah, the finding that they couldn't determine which party was the primary aggressor. And then there is a finding of no domestic violence. And I interpret that to mean that the court didn't conclude that there was that presumption invoked against either one of them. So there's evidence on both sides. We can't determine who's the primary aggressor, and that's how the statute reads. And so it maps with the statute. If you map it that way, both sides, there's domestic violence. We don't know who's the primary aggressor, and so therefore we don't reach a conclusion that invokes this presumption against either one. And the semantics of does that mean there's domestic violence on both sides or no domestic violence on either side? I guess that's what I'm hearing you're finding to be inconsistent. It's irrelevant because the conclusion when it's on both sides is you don't invoke the presumption. And so the actual effect it would have on the decision on whether or not we're going to say they're both perpetrators or they're neither perpetrators, it reaches the same result.
Okay. Well, you still have to use it because the child needs to be protected. So if there's domestic violence, you have to come up with a plan to protect the child.
And that's probably he doesn't spell out that issue, but by finding this, issuing orders that don't have protections in them, issuing an order that has an expansive timeshare for dad, primary custody with mom, in the face of this evidence, certainly everything that flowed from this is indicative of a finding that there isn't sufficient domestic violence for it to be under the statute and invoke that a mutual presumption either. So,
or is it as simple as the fact that they're going to be living 1,300 miles apart between Texas and Las Vegas, and therefore when they live together, they have this volatile relationship. When they're that far apart, they're not going to be seeing each other, so they won't have that relationship, so the child would not be exposed in the same way to this situation.
There are some findings in here somewhat to that effect, showing that mom had left in order to get away from that volatile situation, and that there I believe there was a specific finding that there won't be that same dynamic with mom living apart.
Is that then an abduction, as Mr. Henderson's contending?
Addressing the abduction point, so we have a case that's very, very similar to this one on that abduction element, Druckmann v. Resitti, and we have a situation while it detailed out the law of how you look at these cases, and we now have statutes that kind of mirror that and reiterated that same.
Well, let me ask you the same question I asked your counterpart. The district judge did make a finding that when she took the child out of the state, that was inappropriate. Now, I'm not, same thing I said to him, I'm not sure what that means, but you could read that as saying that was illegal. Why isn't that an abduction then?
I find the judge to be using the word inappropriate to make it very similar to the Druckmann case, which has very similar facts, but even in a you know, this case being a little bit better for mom because she actually had a better reason for leaving, a better reason to leave where she was and a better reason to go to Texas in this case. Whereas in Druckmann v. Resity, mom was leaving just for a job. She didn't have family where she was going. She wasn't leaving a bad situation. So we have a circumstance where two parties living together, unmarried parents, mom up and leaves without permission. And in Druckmann, just like in this case, that court made findings that mom should have primary physical custody and be allowed to stay in California where she was. And in this case, it's a similar situation. And in Druckmann, they didn't use the word inappropriate, but they had very similar sentiments of, you know, this isn't great. We don't like it. You should honor the spirit of the law that you get notice, that you should get permission before you leave. You know, you should really look at the spirit of the law for that, but it's not illegal. And in Druckmann, they didn't find kidnapping in that situation and set out this alternative or this remedy for just this situation, which is the court shouldn't go look at the situation in the new location. That's the remedy to dad in this case. Dad has a remedy for an inappropriate move. And that's that. The court mentions this. The judge did not consider the situation of the child being in Texas, so that's consistent with that Druckmann decision. And this distinction between being in a criminal kidnapping or an illegal kidnapping and being inappropriate. I mean, there's a huge gap between those things. And by the judge using the word inappropriate, it's saying, hey, shame on you. I didn't really like that. But I'm not going to invoke a presumption against you and make a custody order that's not in the best interest of these children because of all the other facts that are at play here.
That's a pretty mild word, inappropriate. I mean, when the statute says don't leave the state without permission or a court order and you do it, that's obviously inappropriate. The question is it's criminal. There's no charges, so it doesn't look like it's criminal, but does it meet the definition of abduction? That's what the appellant is arguing. And you don't need to belabor that point, but it's just the judge gave like a little shake of the finger up. Don't do that. But he still determined, as you said, best interest said stay with mom in Texas.
And, you know, the thing to look at when you want to look at this line between inappropriate and criminal abduction when you're dealing with parents, these are two parents who had lived together. They hadn't ever had involvement of the courts. Custody orders, and you see from our laws how the kidnapping and the statutes for relocation map out. When you have a court order, you have a higher burden to do something to make sure that you get permission to go. But people who've operated without court orders don't know this law, and we then have to look at, and we see in Druckmann and in this case, all of the factors and the intentions of these parties in determining whether or not it goes from, you know, inappropriate to something that would be more. We also have a defense in the kidnapping statute to a situation where you're removing a child from danger or from a situation that certainly the domestic violence evidence that came out in this case would warrant.
Right. And, of course, if an action had been filed in Texas, then the courts would have looked at which is the more appropriate forum, Nevada or Texas, and then could have used a wrongful removal to deny jurisdiction to Texas. I mean, that's where it often comes up, too. In other words, if you wrongfully remove from the original state, you don't get to start a case in the new state. You go back to the original state.
Right. And I don't think jurisdiction is an issue in this one. Let's see, on the domestic violence, there was a lot of argument about how mom had physically been violent with dad, but there was no evidence of physical violence from dad against mom in the case. And certainly it's a strict and inaccurate reading of our domestic violence statutes, which allow for there to be other types of domestic violence. It's not just one person hitting another or hurting them in some way. So our domestic violence statute allows for other mechanisms of domestic violence, although there was evidence of the two different findings were of a physical act, one on each side in this case. that came into evidence for the court to make its decision. We have our family law has had a lot of changes recently, but the fact that the courts need to actually look at the evidence, take into account the situation of each individual case, and we have the Davis case that really, you know, puts a lot of weight on making sure that you're going through the factors and everything else having to do with those people and that case in order to make sure that the decision that you're making is in the best interest of the children that are at issue. And in this situation, while we have, you know, two different presumptions that could be invoked, the court went through and did an analysis, made findings, and reached conclusions that are consistent with those findings and made findings that are consistent with the evidence that was presented and did an analysis and came to a conclusion when you weigh all of the facts, because there are quite a lot of evidence aside from these two issues that would lead to a conclusion that these children should be with their mother in Texas. And the job of the judge is not to just pull out one piece, one element of a case and say, I'm going to just focus on that and ignore the best interest of the children, ignore everything else that's going on, but to look at the entire package and go through each element and each fact and make a decision. And that's what the court did in this case and made a decision that the court believed to be in the best interest of the children. And certainly trying to fault mom for two things that happened in their entire lives, basically, in order to get custody, faulting the court for not just letting dad use two incidents, her moving to Texas and the incident that occurred that resulted in the criminal charges.
You're trying to downgrade it in terms of number, okay? So there's two incidents, but these two incidents, there are different kinds of incidents. If somebody is 5 minutes late picking up a kid, that's an incident, but that's a minor incident. If somebody is committing a crime, a violent crime, there may only be one incident, but a lot of people would say that's a different scope of incident, and therefore that should carry a lot more weight than being 5 minutes late to school. And the same thing with an abduction. Abduction is a crime. So I'm not sure that, you know, that your argument here that there's only two of them is actually what we should be looking at.
Well, except that he's asking for you to have some technicality of it's an abduction when the court didn't find it was an abduction. Inappropriate and abduction criminal charges are completely different things.
All right. Thank you, Ms. McFarland.
Thank you.
All right. I wanted to address the claims of domestic violence on the part of my client, specifically this event that happened in 2006, for which the police were called, but then the district attorney chose never to issue any kind of citation or complaint or anything like that. But more importantly, when this actually came up in trial, Elijah's testimony basically reduces this to just him having hit her hand, accidentally hit her arm in a car door. And that's his testimony, but the other party actually had the opportunity then to give her version of the story, to give a different telling of accounts, and they chose not to. The only testimony that we have on here is something that reduces it to pretty much nothing. And the actual record itself shows that the district attorney found it to be nothing, not to mention that's an event that happened in 2006 versus 2013. So if anything, I think that helps to make more clear how much this is a one-sided thing. There's really only evidence. This idea that there's evidence of both of them having committed domestic violence, you may dispute whether or not there's enough evidence, but there certainly is not evidence of them both having committed it. As to the idea that of violence being more than just hitting, I certainly agree that violence can be more than just physical. I don't think anyone would dispute that. However, that's not in the record here. In the record here, and in the judge's order, all he talks about is yelling. And that's, if that is your basis for domestic violence, I think it has to be explored a little more and not just, come up with it once you're at the appeal level. And then finally, as concerns the deduction, I think that the case has been pretty clearly made as to whether or not it's the letter of the law. I would like to distinguish this a little from Juckman, in that Juckman was a case where the parties were already talking about relocating. The mother was looking for another job. She found another job, and then she left. In this case, the mother had a job. The parties had just signed a new lease. There was no discussion of leaving, and then she abruptly left without telling him, had to go find a new job when she was in Texas. And so it's a pretty substantially different set of circumstances. And so in conclusion, what we're really asking, we are not in any way asking that it should not be the best interest of the child that should decide this case. But the statute is clear that my client is entitled to a presumption on account of domestic violence. He is entitled to a presumption on account of abduction. And
well, even if we're unclear on this, and I think to follow up on what Judge Tao had originally asked, from this order, it appears that either the presumption wasn't applied or that presumption was rebutted because the court then found the best interest of the child should stay in Texas.
Right.
Either way you go. I mean, I suppose you could remand and make a finding, and you make the finding, and then the judge says, but it was rebutted with the rest of the evidence.
Well, our argument is that frankly, the court was wrong as concerned with domestic violence, and therefore that presumption should have been applied in Elijah's favor. And as I read it, because the court does seem to really skate around the word abduction, even though it lists all of the elements, the court did not make that finding and did not apply that presumption, and therefore the presumption cannot be rebutted. And it's our argument that this case, it's in the interest of the children, it's in the interest of justice, for this case to be heard with those statutorily required presumptions. And if Elijah still loses, then so be it, but he's entitled to those presumptions. That's it.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Henderson, counsel, both for your very good work on this case and also the pro bono program. This is a good example of why we have that program, help people out, and give counsel a chance for an argument, too. So this matter will stand submitted. We'll issue a decision at a later point, hopefully not too long from now.